Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance.
Dr. Jonathan Cowan with us, PhD, the founder and chairman of Neurotech, a well-known and respected researcher and pioneer in, here it comes, interactive performance enhancement training. He's a peak performance specialist who understands that neuro-video feedback technology has the ability to improve people's lives by increasing their focus and decreasing their stress. He earned his PhD from the University of California in San Francisco. And let us say, Jonathan, hi, welcome to the show.
It's a real pleasure to be here, Michael Ray.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's start from the very beginning. You know, there was something called biofeedback that has been around for a long time. Practicality. Jonathan, brainwave biofeedback. What are we talking about? We'll set the base, and then we'll move forward.
Well, what brainwave biofeedback is the process of providing information to you about the way your brain is functioning. Its focus, the degree of alertness, its moods, and how well messages are being sent and received from one part to another. The purpose is to improve how you function by enhancing your control of your brain.
Okay, so there are pathways in the brain, and the brain effectively functions, I'm going to say, in certain ways. The brain is basically an electrochemical factory, and if things are working properly, the function happens. But if things aren't working properly, if there are disconnects in that brain, what happens when that happens?
Well, what happens if you have a disconnect is that the brain has to struggle to do something else that's different, and the executive functions of the brain start to kick in, but that takes a lot more effort, and it really brings things into consciousness. So there are parts of the brain that can compensate over a period of time, but the thing is that in order for the system to really work well, all the parts have to be functioning together, and certain parts have to be under better control than we usually have.
Okay, but so there is a way to allow me to realize where I'm short, quote unquote, what I'm missing to be able to get that peak performance. Now, brainwaves, etc. Now, so many times that people have to go out to different places. They've got to go and they've got to get specialized software and places where they deal with this. But there's a step that you guys have created beyond that, isn't there?
Yes, we've created a couple of systems called the Peak Achievement Trainer and the Peak Brain Happiness Trainer, which you can actually buy and use at home. And these are far more accurate than the systems that you might have heard of that are incorporated in toys. Sure. These are serious systems that can actually give you really good information about three fundamental dimensions of mental processing: your focus, how single-pointed you are on something, your degree of alertness, and what we call Eureka. Eureka is a brain system that we have identified from looking at a wide variety of studies and matching them up with a measurement, and it turns out to be a signal, a protocol that responds to a brain system that's the system of new learning, new discovery. We call it neural Eureka or Neurika, and we are able to actually teach people how to enhance Eureka as well as the other two. When you enhance Eureka, not only do you enhance your memory, but the thing that's very intriguing about it is it makes you feel good.
Okay,
and
let me hold you up for a minute, okay? Let's put this into a practical scenario. I decide that I want to get quicker. I want to function better. I want to become more focused, more alert, and I've been having the problem and I couldn't quite do it. So I come to you guys. What's the first step?
Well, basically, we are actually selling the systems for people to use in their home with a complete video training course. There are practitioners that you could come to that would help you with this. Okay, the first step is basically that you sit down in front of a computer and you're wearing a headband that has sensors that pick up your brain waves. And then these brain waves are amplified and converted to digital information that's sent to the computer. The computer analyzes it further by applying these protocols and then displays it in ways that can be easily understood by you. Some of our best designs also include video. We call them neuro video feedback. In one approach, for example, you can control a DVD with your brain's outputs from these three protocols, the focus, the alertness, and the eureka. So that, for example, it plays when you're focused and it stops when you're not. The picture gets larger as you focus more.
Sure.
Another type of this neuro video feedback actually creates videos of your activities and records and feeds them back to you along with the brainwave information.
Okay, well, let me hold you up. So I want to make sure everybody's got this. So let's say, for instance, that I'm a client and I get the software, I bring it home, and then there's the training program to take me through how to use it. What am I going to see in the training program? Not the entire program, obviously, but one or two things that I can actually wrap my mind around to experience what it is we're dealing with.
Well, for example, you'll have an exercise that will enhance your focus, several of them. And what this means is that, for example, as you focus more, there's a yellow bar that measures your focus that goes up higher. And then it comes down as you ease off. You may also see on a history display, what we call a trend display, how you've been doing for the last minute. So you can look and see what you did that really made a difference. We give you some numerical measures, and then in the more advanced protocols, we'll also allow you to control a DVD so that as you sit there and you focus, the DVD plays one of your favorite movies and moves forward, and the more that you focus, the bigger the picture on the DVD gets.
Okay, let me hold you up just for a minute. So, let's go back to the numerical guide to where I'm at. So let's say we're dealing with focus, right? Most people don't they don't have a base. They don't have a something to recognize or an image or a feeling for what focus is. So if I'm looking at this and I realize that based on the numbers, the numerical numbers, let's say from 6 to 8, I know if I'm up at 8, I've got a certain experience. I'm feeling it in a certain way. I'm holding my attention. If I let it drop, obviously it's less. So then when I'm away from the machine and I'm at my desk and I want to focus, I can recreate the experience that I had because now I know what it feels like to be focused at a degree where it goes beyond what I normally would.
You got it. That's exactly right.
Okay. All right. So in essence, it gives us a feeling of what it's like that we can we can repeat it when we're away from the software.
Sometimes I like to think of it as it teaches you where the switch in your brain is.
Yeah, okay.
And how to flip it. That's a little simplified, but that basically is the sense that you get.
Yeah, but you got to know what it feels
self-control
like.
Self-control taken to the max.
Ah, okay. Now, you were talking about going to the pleasure centers of the brain. Now, so effectively, let's say that I've got the software. Does it help increase the dopamine level?
We believe it does. We believe there's a definite tie-in to what we call the prefrontal pleasure center. It turns out that more recent research done at Stanford has discovered that the dopamine systems actually go right up to behind the middle of your forehead, and this is where we happen to put our sensor. There's a lot of fascinating research that indicates that not only is it related to positive feelings, but it's related to the experience of beauty and desire. So all of those things are tied together in brain systems that are very closely located under our sensor, and they seem to cause a response in our system so that when you are feeling happier or you're exposed to beautiful things on the DVD that we show you, you feel better, and the eureka level goes up.
Well, let me take it a different way, okay? Because I'm listening very closely to you, and from I'm not a clinician, but you know, with all of all of the interviews that I've done over the years, one of the things that I got into, and I did a little bit of research on, which was kind of interesting, people that have addictions, alcohol, drug, etc. From what I understand, and stop me if I'm wrong here, that there is a blockage to their dopamine. And if they don't have the dopamine, they're not feeling good. They go to drugs. They go to alcohol, which, quote, unquote, replaces the dopamine experience. So what I'm hearing and what I'm thinking is, I don't know if you guys have done it or not, but you could actually use this in helping to neutralize addiction.
We are very interested in that. And, in fact, one of our early studies with Eureka did involve a group of people who were pre-addiction in their referral from the court, brought them in. And what we found was that we were able to enhance their feelings of happiness quite substantially, and that the increase lasted unabated for 4 months. Now, my personal history actually resonates with what you said very well, because many years ago I used to work for the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and the director there at the Addiction Research Center had a particular theory that there were these mood disorders, which he called hypophoria. And I published papers about hypophoria and the components of this hypophoria many years ago. Unfortunately, he moved on, the field moved on, and it got relabeled perhaps as what we call dysthymia. But the idea is that there are these negative feeling states, and we know that they are related to deficits in dopamine. Dr. Kenneth Blum, who's a colleague of mine, has tested this system, and he said, oh, this is it. This is that dopamine feeling. I can tell that when I enhance my dopamine output, as I understand it from my many years of study, this eureka goes up. Let's do some research.
No, absolutely. My contention would be, if you could use that in the proper places, my goodness, look at the lives that you can end up turning around and changing. The other thing I'm hearing also is this might be a great way to offset depression.
Well, I think it is in one meaning of depression, depressed feelings. I'm not quite so sure in terms of what we call major depression. This dysthymia is really a constant low feeling state, but it isn't accompanied by many of the vegetative kinds of symptoms of depression, loss of appetite, loss of interest in sex, sleep problems, and so on. Not clearly as much. Our system, when we tested it on these folks, basically did decrease what's called the Beck Depression Inventory Scale scores initially, right after we trained them compared to before. But that didn't last 4 months. But the feelings of happiness did.
Okay, well, let's take this another step. If you're dealing also now with neurosciences, when you talk about depression keeps you depressed. It keeps down those feelings that you don't feel that you can experience. When something like that happens, you are dealing with the autonomic nervous system. And if you're dealing with the autonomic nervous system, sympathetic, parasympathetic nervous system, you're also dealing with neurosciences, you're dealing with chemicals, and I wonder if it would be possible, and I'm asking, to be able to change it, because obviously that the old fight-or-flight syndrome, if you could change it through what you have, depression seems like it would disappear also. I am really hearing that if what you have used properly, it could be the answer to a whole lot of problems that you might not even have thought of.
Well, we keep thinking, Michael Ray, and we keep coming up with things that it can be used for. You're right on track with a lot of this, and we would love to have the funding to do the research that would take us into a number of these areas. Depression is important, but you know, there's something that's even more important because it affects everyone, and that's health and success. We know now that there are 157 studies that have been done that show that if you're happy now, you're going to be healthier later. And we actually took the question from one study, the happiness question, and we used it in our study. And that study was done by the Australian government, had almost 10,000 people in it. And what they found was that if you were happier at one time, if they came back 3 years later, the odds were 50% more that you would be healthier and freer of long-term health consequences. We also know that there are relationships between happiness leading to success. It's not just the other way around, success leading to happiness. There are a number of studies that show that this is true. So,
yeah, Jonathan, let me hold you.
It's a very interesting kind of possibility here.
Yeah, I really don't like doing this because I could talk about this all night, but we are running out of time. Is there a website that we can find you at, get more information, and i.e. order the software?
Yes. Our website is peakbrainhappiness.com.
Okay, www.peakbrainhappiness.com. Hey, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. I think you got a great thing going, and I hope you find some investors to really get it out there.
Well, we appreciate being able to talk about it with you. Michael, you're very well informed, and it's been a delight.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
So why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan and Capri.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You are listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. I needed help with that one. Our guest, Robin Woodall, holds a BS in exercise science, worked in the health and fitness industry since 1997. She is the founder of the MindBody HCG weight loss method and educates doctors, clinics, and patients on how the HCG protocol works. Robin's the author of Weight Loss Apocalypse, Emotional Eating Rehab Through the HCG Protocol. Robin, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we deal with weight loss, my goodness, it's just a subject that so many Americans today are forced to address on a daily basis. You lose weight, comes back, mm-hmm. You know the health risk, you experience the feeling of loss of control, you find a new program because maybe you're not happy with the emotional ups and downs, you try another program, same old promises, and you end up back at square zero. And then I think you begin to realize that something has been missing. And I'm going to throw this over to you. What did you find? What's the missing link?
Well, the missing link is the fact that we continue to blame our weight as being the problem when in reality, Michael, it's a consequence of something different. And, you know, the diet industry has been such a massive failure, partly because they continually perpetuate the idea that weight is the problem. And what I'm finding is that weight, like I said, is a consequence. It's an outcome. And it's caused by a desire to eat. So what we're really dealing with is behavior with food and emotional desire to eat. So you can lose all the weight you want. However, if you don't change the way you like to eat, you'll always go back to that, and you'll gain it right back. So, again, the problem is that we're really misdirected in our efforts, And I think that, you know, people are sick and tired of the game of weight loss and this, you know, quote unquote battle with weight, and they're ready for some personal accountability. And I think that's what people are ready for.
Okay, so in essence, so, what you're saying, and stop me if I'm wrong here, what I'm hearing is weight is a behavioral problem. You learn to eat, you learn to enjoy it, you learn that it's an emotional stabilizer, and yet at the same time, if you can learn, you can unlearn and relearn. So the big problem is it's not the diets, it's the behavior behind the diets that cause the problem. Is that what I heard?
Yeah, it's the behavior behind the desires to eat that have nothing to do with the body. You know, if you look at the American culture, we don't eat because we're hungry. We eat because we're bored, because we aren't as creative as we used to be, and because that food provides us something to do. It's something we do to celebrate. It's something we do for every single event, outing, family function. If you're sad, depressed, excited, it's become an emotional object rather than a physical object. And the human body doesn't work emotionally. It works physically. And go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say HCG.
So the idea behind the concept is Michael, is if there was something that took the abundance of our food away, where the easy access to food was just gone completely, let's say something cataclysmic happens, and you're left with the food you have in your home right now, the decision to eat all of a sudden doesn't make sense to eat for emotional reasons out of boredom. Does that make sense? So
absolutely.
You wouldn't eat out of boredom any longer because it doesn't make physical sense. But because we have all this abundance, the American way of eating is because we have access, so we use it for our emotional bias. And we blame that as the problem, not the cause of the desires to eat because of how much access we have to it.
Now, fat in and of itself is an interesting thing. If you go to, up north to Alaska and you get into the Eskimo villages, you find something called muktuk. Mm-hmm. Muktuk is whale blubber, and they eat tons of that during the winter to survive. You got 40, 50 below zero. So obviously it's also a survival mechanism. But then along came something called HCG. Now, on a practical level, how does that become the missing link to most people's problem?
Well, to be honest with you, it isn't a missing link to the problem. The true missing link is personal responsibility. So let's just put that right out there, because there's tons of people doing the HCG protocol to lose weight, and they gain it right back as soon as they go back to the way they like to eat. But here's what the HCG protocol does. HCG is a pregnancy hormone. It's found from the placenta of pregnant women, and what we know today is that HCG stimulates the hormone leptin. Now, leptin is a very fascinating hormone. It is basically the king of all hormones. And leptin in a pregnant woman is what regulates her metabolic system, the fuel availability, if that makes sense. And
sure.
HCG stimulates leptin in low doses. So if HCG is a low dose, leptin starts to stimulate from the placenta. And what that does is it reduces the pregnant woman's need for food hormonally. Food also stimulates leptin. And so if HCG is stimulating leptin, then you don't need something else to do it as well. Does that make sense?
Sure it does.
So, yeah, so during pregnancy, a woman actually needs less food hormonally. Her need for food nutritionally is much higher, but hormonally is less. And leptin is the hormone that causes fat gain.
Okay, but does the let me ask you this question, and stop me if I'm wrong. I'm not a doctor and I'm not a weight loss specialist, but from what I understand, with the HCG, does that not feed on the extra fat? Effectively, it becomes the way to get rid of the fat, because the HCG actually feeds on it, and if you're feeding on it, you don't have to store it, and if you don't have to store it, you don't have to gain weight.
Well, actually, that is incorrect. HCG does not burn fat. That's a common misconception that's been taught out of just not knowing how it works. So people assume that HCG is a fat-burning hormone, and it is not. In fact, it's the hormone that makes a pregnant woman more susceptible to fat gain. What HCG is doing is manipulating the hormone leptin, and leptin is the hormone that is necessary to unlock the fuel from your fat. And it's really a fueling mechanism that is required to make sure that the body is getting enough and adequate amounts of fuel to support the mechanisms that the entire body has. So in order for you to live day to day, you need leptin to release fuel from your fat so that your fat is providing that fuel. Now, if you don't have enough leptin, and this is where the science of starvation comes in, if you do not have adequate amounts of leptin in your body, your fat can no longer supply adequate fuel. And that places an incredible amount of demand on other fueling substrates such as blood glucose, glycogen, and body protein. And it also, you know, leptin is such an incredible hormone. It's the king of the entire endocrine system, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It not only regulates the release of fuel, but inside the brain, leptin is a messenger, and it's a message. It brings to the brain a message of confidence. So if you have more leptin, your brain is more confident that it has fuel. And so when leptin levels go down in starvation, the brain signals to the endocrine system or the hormonal system of the body to start to conserve as if there's not enough fuel. So the thyroid suppresses and that reduces demand for fuel. The adrenals get a little more active. And so what the HCG is doing is it's stimulating leptin levels so that you're telling the body and the brain to release fuel and the brain to be confident that everything is doing great. Now, what I really need to explain here, too, Michael, is that the HCG protocol requires that the patient follow a very low-calorie protocol, less than 500 calories for the majority of people. And 500 calories would be considered a starvation diet. And so the big question is, you know, obviously you're going to lose weight eating that amount of food, but how could you lose all fat with that? How could you prevent starvation? How is starvation preventable? And that's where the HCG is required. So much skepticism is about this protocol is based on the fact that the amount of calories is so low. And without acknowledging the fact that there's a hormone in place here that might change the mechanisms of starvation. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me hold you up just a minute. I've seen HCG advertised. It comes across the internet. And also, and we both know someone who I absolutely love this guy. You know who I'm talking about, who lost a ton of weight because of the program. All right. And I've known him for years. But the point of contention is that if I were going to do this, I would get this from a medically, approved place. It would come into somebody who could actually prescribe the HCG. But there's so much of that running around the internet. Robin, how much of it's legitimate and does it have the potency and the power that you would get from someone who worked with it constantly that's here?
The internet world of HCG has pretty much hijacked the protocol. And it's the diet industry and it's consumers that have really hijacked it, and they've taken it, manipulated it. They're creating new ways to get HCG, and it's not it's not as reputable. That is for sure. This is a hormonal therapy. The HCG is manipulating the endocrine system, the fueling systems of the body, and it should not be taken lightly. And ideally, you are doing it with a medical professional that knows the mechanisms that are occurring and how it works. So medical HCG by far is, you should get the support you need.
That's why I think
the problem here, Michael, is not enough people or even doctors know how it works. So the doctors who are prescribing, most of them aren't aware of this modern science. They don't understand HCG, but they know it works. and it works amazing, and it's definitely unique. This is not a diet, and it doesn't work like other diets.
Sure, but Robin,
and so
how do I find someone?
How do you
Someone who has?
Well, you know what I tell everybody to call your local compound pharmacy. Those are the pharmacies that mix HCG, and they know who's prescribing. That's a great way to start with whatever area you live.
Okay, now the book. Let's go to the book for a minute. Weight Loss Apocalypse, The Emotional Eating Rehab Through the HCG Protocol. What do I learn in the book? What's this book going to give me when I walk away?
Well, there's two parts to this book. There is the physiology behind how this works. Why HCG prevents starvation during a 500 calorie. Why, with the hundreds and hundreds of people I've worked with, why metabolic rates go up after eating 500 calories. I go into detail about the modern science that is available at our fingertips that could explain how that actually could be. So it's not a mystery anymore. The other part of this book is focusing on the personal responsibility that it will require each individual to do for themselves to change the way they eat. You know, we live in the most gluttonous culture in the world, and that isn't going to change just because you lose fat. You've got to learn to eat less because you want to. That is by far, I believe, the heart and soul of the book. It's really getting into making the intrinsic change of desire so that you no longer want to excessively eat, even though you could, even though that food is at your fingertips, that you by choice are eating less based on the physical need for food, not your emotional desire.
No, by the way,
that's what Weight Loss Apocalypse is really about.
I know somebody personally, and we're talking about Mayer, you know him too. I know somebody personally.
I love him.
Oh, absolutely. Well over 100 pounds. I mean, my goodness, to see a picture of him today
Amazing.
As opposed to, a year ago, and his wife also. So effectively, everything you're saying is so spot on. I have seen it work, and I've seen it work, and the guy's a medical doctor. And by the way, he's also a JD, so if he steps out of line, he can sue himself. That's Mayer. So anyway, yeah. So, but when you really come down to it, I've seen it work. I've seen it with somebody who is obese and brought them down to a realistic weight that they can work with. And I think what you're saying tonight, with all of the interviews that I've done, I think that you're spot on with this, because there's so much information out there and there's so much hype out there about weight loss that most people get frustrated and they quit trying, because how many times can you try and end up back where you started?
Yeah, well, and like I said, the problem isn't the weight. That's the side effect. That's the byproduct. And there's no doubt there's profound reasons to eat less. There is, you know, and to lose that fat. There's hormonal implications. There are definite ramifications from obesity. However, that is not the cause of the problem. It's the side effect. And so what we really got to look at is our cultural binge eating disorder. We have a massive cultural eating disorder because it's normal. No one knows it's existing. Everybody does it, so we all think that it's okay. I mean, look at Thanksgiving. It's a full-day binge fest based on the idea that we're celebrating something, and it's self-mutilating to the body, but we justify it. It's an addiction. And the diet industry, they don't want to give you personal responsibility, because if you do, then you don't need them. You don't need to pay them to tell you what to do to eat less. And the other part is the continued blame on weight is the problem continues to take the personal responsibility away from the individual. And it puts it on this diet that you paid for.
Robin, I hate to do this. We're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you this. I could talk to you about this all night, but is there a website we can find you at? Where do we order the book, and how do we get more information?
Well, you can order the book on the internet at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, on any internet book distributing center. My website is at weightlossapocalypse.com. I've got a Facebook, Weight Loss Apocalypse, also YouTube, Weight Loss Apocalypse. So go in there and search engine Weight Loss Apocalypse, and you'll find everything you need.
Wonderful. Hey, Robin, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. For nearly 20 years now, Emmy Award-winning journalist Chris Paltrow traveled the world as a television news reporter. And since 2005, she's been working as a media strategist, and she's the author of what she calls the ultimate newscast. Her book, Eyewitness News, Eyewitness Miracles, A Reporter's Notebook, is the first in an inspirational series and the companion piece for her motivational speaking engagements. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be talking to you.
Oh, thank you. Everything is a miracle in its own way, isn't it? Sometimes they happen in front of us and we don't see them, but if we look, if we just get present for the moment, man, they're out there.
You know, miracles, or maybe you call them coincidences or runs of good luck, or just, you know, synchronicities, they're happening all the time, whether you decide to notice them or not. And basically, I'm just saying noticing them and experiencing them is a much happier way to live.
Okay, now where was it for you when that aha moment, that first, that recognition of there is a miracle and it's out there, and where did you see your first one?
My first miracle? Oh, goodness. Well, that would, that would take me going back into my childhood where these things would happen to me, but I just didn't know what to call them at that time. But you know what really inspired me to collect these stories from my childhood and up until now is that as a TV news reporter for nearly 20 years, we were always told to tell the bad news, even if something good was going on behind the scenes, even in the same story. And I started to think, well, wouldn't people want to hear about the good stuff that's happening at the same time? And the consultant said, no, and don't you dare talk about miracles. You know, you're a journalist after all. And so I just collected the stories and decided to put them in a book and have an ultimate newscast of my own.
You know, it's interesting that the public at large, we, and I have to say we, I'm part of the public. Absolutely. And it's just exactly what you were told. We've been taught to listen for the bad stuff. And, you know, some of the things that I'll watch, I've got the TV on behind me 24 hours a day, obviously, to keep my fingers on the pulse of what's going on. But at the same time, the junk that goes on, and then you wonder why some of these kids get off and get in the trouble that they get into, because the only thing that they hear with this myriad of madness that's out there is how bad things are.
Yeah, and it's so easy to get sucked down into that negative frame of mind. And considering the 24/7 negative news that is all around us, you know,
sure.
It's no wonder that we fall into that trap. And what I'm saying is, you know, there's another way to do it, and the best advice I ever got as I was trying to kind of wind my way through all this negative stuff and not become a terminal cynic is that see yourself as a consumer of the information you put in your head. You know, it's like a diet. It's not the food that makes you fat. It's what you choose to eat that makes you fat. And the same with negativity. It's not the news itself that makes you feel negative and depressed and gives you a bad experience of life. It's what you choose to put in your head and what you choose to consume as a viewer, as a listener, as a reader, that really frames your experience. And I'm saying there's a different way to look at life, and it's pretty darn easy. If I can do it, really anyone can.
Sure, and you talk about miracles. I think it was the last day or two, and I'll give you the way that I looked at it. There was a couple of young women who just drove off an embankment, and they ended up in the water, and they were starting to drown, and there was a cop who, quote-unquote, happened to be there, right? Mm-hmm. And he got out there, and he saved them. Effectively, that's a major miracle, and it was time and place. Why was he there at that particular time? Why was he not in his car? You hear what I'm saying. So if we really look at it, we are being watched over. I totally and completely believe that.
Well, and the thing is, no matter what your belief system is, what your social standing is, you don't need any special skills to see or experience these miracles. It's really to notice those kinds of things that are happening that make you believe that there's something ultimately loving out there, whatever you call it, that's sure. managing all this craziness, and that really is caring for you as a, you know, being on this earth. And it just, seeing your life like that is just a much more pleasant way to experience the life that you have.
You know, interestingly enough, one of your talking points, and it's very true, how focusing on negative news actually breeds suspicion and drives us apart. That those are the operative words, drives us apart. This country, toe-to-toe, there is not another country in the world that could stand up to us. You want to take care of us. You want us to fall apart. You divide us, and it comes from within. And if you dilute who we are, you dilute the very strength of who we've been and who we're going to be. And when we get all the news that you're talking about, there is a division because they're so, you know, it's the Republican against the Democrat, and it's black against white, and it's the men against women. And I mean, this thing goes on. And the kids growing up today, you're right, they don't get to see the miracles. What they do is they get very defensive and very protective of themselves because of what they hear and see.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things that bothered me so much was to consistently report on things like, you know, scams targeting seniors or your charity money going for fraud. And all of a sudden, you look at everybody, even the most well-intended people who approach you, and just you're thinking, what do you want from me? What's in it for you? And it breeds suspicion and drives us apart. And, you know, I'm not advocating that anyone be naive and let themselves become victims over and over again. But expecting the best out of a situation and the best out of people and occasionally being disappointed, you know, having that approach versus the opposite just frames your whole experience of life in a more positive way. And it's, you know, it's a choice, and it's an easy choice to make. And, boy, you know, being mired in the negativity 24/7 like I had been for 20 years as a reporter, this is a much better way to do things.
No, absolutely, no question about it. But seeing it from the inside out, if you had the proverbial magic wand and you could change something, you became queen of the media. What would you change? How would you do it? And the one problem that you would have, what you would have to face, we have been trained at this time to look for the look for the bad, quote unquote. If you see man bites dog, okay, well that's something we're going to look at. But who cares? Mm-hmm. What about something that, Susie was in the market and she helped a 70-year-old man out of the market because he was having trouble. He was old enough. He wasn't strong enough to carry his groceries. What's wrong with that? But nobody wants to buy that.
Well, we've been conditioned not to buy that. And it's kind of the, the gawker mentality. When there's a train wreck, you're going to slow down to look at that. And when, you know, somebody is helping somebody else along the side of the road, you probably won't pay as much attention. So it's, you know, I'm not faulting the media for kind of feeding the market that's out there.
Yeah.
What I'm suggesting is that the market takes the power back and changes its consuming habits. And
sure.
You have to do that on an individual basis. We're not going to change the media. I would love to wave my magic wand back to the days where, you know, kids, puppies, and parades made the headlines, but it's not going to happen. But we can change what we consume and put in our heads and in our hearts, and that informs new habits, and that changes what we do on a daily basis. So my magic wand can't be aimed at the media, but it can be aimed at each and every one of us who can change our minds.
Oh, sure. And it used to be, you know, the small towns, the newspapers. It was about who did what in the neighborhood and local politicians and quote unquote. They eventually, for the most part, and I would say for the 90%, 95% for the most, got bought out corporately, and then the media got controlled. And it's really, when it comes down to it, it's all about, Chris, it's all about the money. And if it's not going to sell, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. You know how many times you've heard that.
And that was my mission statement for many years, yes.
There you go. And if it's not going to sell, there's no reason to put it up there. But at the same time, if we want a change in the culture that we live in, the media has a lot to do with it because they set the pattern of how people are going to behave.
That's absolutely right. I couldn't agree with you more. We just have to make sure that the media isn't making our decisions for us. We can use it to inform our decisions, but don't let it be the guide. I absolutely loved my job as a TV news reporter. I respect the media's power and the need for media in our society. But, you know, when you look at how you inform your life and decide to act from it, you have to take your power back, and that's what Eyewitness News, Eyewitness Miracles is really all about.
Yeah, and by the way, seeing through it also. One other thing about quote-unquote negative media, which drives me nuts, but people love to see this, and it's got to do with the media has confused itself with soap operas.
Yeah.
They live in this stuff, and it's the I watch people be interviewed. Somebody will go through this horrific problem, and the reporter will say, "And how'd you feel about watching your family dying?" You know, I mean, what is this stuff?
You know, one of my role models when I was a reporter was an anchor out of Chicago. Her name is Carol Marine, and she often talked about that awful kind of trajectory that reporters would go down asking how people felt, and it made her crazy. And she said, you know, her question was, "Can you tell me about it?" And that, to me, was a much more respectful question and a more informative question, because how did you feel? Well, anybody who asks that question amidst a tragedy kind of deserves, you know, the media branding that they get, the negative media. So, that drove me crazy, too, and I think there's a much better, more responsible way that reporters can handle themselves in those situations.
Yeah, and by the way, I think what you're doing is phenomenal because more and more people should get this kind of a message. I am what I, or better yet, what I get modeled for me is what I become, and that's basically what we're like. So the models have to change. They have to change drastically, and that has to do not necessarily with the political life, but it starts in your neighborhoods. It starts with being able to walk down the street and smile at somebody instead of walking down the street and worry that somebody's going to take you out in the back and beat you up.
Well, I absolutely agree. And, you know, the way that I address the everyday miracles in my book, I talk about the news miracles, but there are 7 other chapters, one of parenting, relationships, pets, money, jobs, things that we all do every day in our homes, in our neighborhoods, at work, where you can pick out the miracles in your own situation. And at the end of each chapter, there's some easy-to-follow tips where you can start to change your mind and how you see things, and all of a sudden, you know, you're a step ahead in this miracle business. And so it's just it's a new way to look at things. Just like you said, it starts with your home, yourself, and your own life.
Yeah. I give you a miracle. There was this little pussycat that's running around here who was seconds away from being put down, and I happened to get a hold of her. And because she didn't pass the test, she was nasty. She was hissing at people. And that's that same cat 5 minutes ago that was rubbing on the microphone. And if you listen very closely, you could probably hear her purring into it. That's a miracle.
That is a miracle. And, you know, pets bring us those miracles, and kids do, and our jobs do, and even the bad stuff in life. I've got a chapter called 2020 Hindsight Miracles. Believe me, I've made my share of mistakes in my 40-some years. And to be able to go back and pull the good stuff out of that and purr your or pull your kittens out of the, you know, crazy lions and tigers that are out there and really see the value that they've brought to your life. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about.
Absolutely. It's looking at those things that are right in front of you that you didn't, here comes the big R word, that you didn't recognize, and they're right there in front of you. And I wonder how many, yeah, a great example of this, and I probably use this example 7,000 times, and Radio Susie's over there going, oh, he's going to do it again. I know he is. are you sitting in front of a desk?
Am I? Yes, I am. Yeah.
Okay, touch the desk, okay?
Yep.
All right, now, until you touch that desk, Chris, that desk wasn't even in existence, was it? It wasn't even there, was it?
No, my head was kind of right there with you.
Yeah, but the desk, it was there, but it wasn't there. And that, I think, is where the problem is. We don't take the time to really realize that there are things around us. We're not noticing anything anymore. We got so wrapped up in who we are and what we're doing and all this other stuff that we don't even know that the desk is there or the pen is there or the husband, the wife, the somebody. We walk right by them. And I'll give you a quick example because we're going to have to shut down pretty soon. There was a play called Our Town. And I think this ties into what you're doing. It was about a woman who passed away, and she was standing there one night with the angels. And the angel said, you know, you can have a wish, and you can go, if you want to, you can go back to Earth one day, and you choose when you want to do it. And I think it was maybe her 12th birthday. So she goes back down, and she's home again. She's in her room. She's dressed up. It's her birthday. She's got a birthday dress on, just looking great. And she runs down. She gets halfway down the stairs, and her dad is there. And she said, Dad, look at me. She said, look at my dress. Look at me. It's my birthday. And he looked at her and said, don't bother me right now. I'm busy. I've got to go make money to pay for this party. And she gets downstairs, and she said, Mama, look at me. Look at my dress. Look at me. It's my birthday. And she said, don't bother me now. I'm making your cake. I'm getting ready for the party. And the kid looked up in the sky, and she started crying, and she said, I want to come back. It's too tough down here. And in essence, the miracles are just look around your house. Look around at what you have and touch them.
They're right there for the taking, and to be present and to experience the now. And I know that's overused, but we're too busy in our heads, and the miracles are right there in front of us.
No, absolutely. And if anybody wants to ask you what happened in this interview, you just very simply say, I found out I had a desk.
Well, at least I got that. Absolutely. Hey, may I add one more thing? Because I know you have to close down here, but I really am collecting miracles for the second newscast here, and I'm encouraging everyone to send me their miracle stories for the second version of this book to my email account, and I know you're posting that for your listeners. So sure. I welcome all miracles. I'm equal opportunity miracle journalist here, and I'm excited to bring more to the people that need them, which I think is pretty much just about everybody.
Everybody. And, okay, a website we can find you at by the book?
ChrisPatro.com.
Okay, wonderful. And that's PatroKris, ChrisPatro.com. Hey, Chris, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for your time.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
I can only give you love that lasts forever and the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demand. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Give you the world for a toy. All
have all these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Jane Symington with us holds a PhD in health sciences, a master's of nursing, and a bachelor's in psychology. She's a certified clinical hypnotherapist and a Reiki master, as well as the owner of Taking Flight International, a public keynote speaker, a media guest. Jane's work includes the book, listen to it, Journey to the Sacred, Mending a Fractured Soul and Setting the Captive Free, and the award-winning film Listening to Soul Pain and Healing Soul Pain. And let us say, Jane, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's my honor.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we talk about this word grief, and so many people go through it. I imagine that it's got two separate definitions to it. One is a literal physical definition, and then there's got to be an inner definition where you can somehow change that strength in the grief to something that will work for you. So let's start out with, what is grief?
Well, I think you did a good job of describing that there are actually two sides to grief. Many people only look at the mourning side, the deep grief, the deep pain. But grief actually also has a transformative side, a side where we go deep within and we look deeply at ourselves and we move forward. And while people in the beginning of their grief journey never like to hear that this will change them and transform them, anybody who's been through that over a period of time are able to look back at life and say, I have changed. Things are not the same. I don't see things the same. What was once important is not important to me. Things are very different for me now. So there is usually a huge change and often a very spiritual change that happens for people.
And that spiritual change we're talking about, whatever you want to call it, let's call it the soul, that essence of who you are, wherever it's connected to. Do you ever lose the soul, or does it get buried in such grief and such anxiety and so much resentment that people carry that you don't recognize it anymore, and you've got to have this door with this key to open that door to get back to who you are and the reality of your own truth?
Well, I really agree with all the statements you've made. I believe very much in soul pain. I believe that soul pain is much deeper than what we normally look at in psychology. Soul pain is more an intense depth. We've lost trust. We're struggling with our beliefs. We can't find meaning in the experience. Why did this happen to me? And we really struggle with the new purpose in our life. And so you ask, do people lose part of that? Indigenous people since ancient times have believed that when we go through a very difficult, traumatic, challenging life experience, we can perhaps leave a part of ourself, our psyche, and they call it as a soul, at the place of the tragedy. And so indigenous peoples have always had a way of reclaiming those parts, and now many psychotherapists, myself included, have brought that part of healing into practice as well, because people feel that they have a piece of themselves behind, and they don't feel whole until that piece is reclaimed.
Okay, when you talk about indigenous people, are you talking about Indians? You're talking about people that are in tribes in different countries? Is that what you mean when you say indigenous?
Yeah, primal. So, as you described it, yes. So, people from many parts of the world, and I've worked in many parts of the world, tribal peoples have had this belief and still hold that belief.
Okay, and I think one of the advantages that they have that we don't, we have cultural blocks. We have all of these things that we've been taught that they haven't. All of those challenges and the roadblocks and the things that we have to move through to get to the first step of finding our soul or who we are, that it's not there. If I can walk out into the woods and sit for a day or so, and I think the word meditate is probably overused, but just get centered with myself to be able to allow everything to move away so I could get to the essence. It's very hard for most people to do that are living in the kind of culture, this fast-paced, microwavable world that we live in today.
Well, culture definitely done that to many people, and many people, as you state, are really on an intense journey to reclaim that true essence of themselves. And so it's not only culture, it's education, it's religious practices. Many of those practices have said that things like soul retrieval, which, you know, shamans are used to do, that that's not a right thing to do. And so many people, though, are recognizing, many therapists are recognizing that there is a fragmented aspect that can happen as we go through grief. And so we talk about fragmented self. And part of that means that we need to get body, mind, and spirit back. And so certainly walking in nature, looking at, you know, was very therapeutic for me, and it's something I always recommend. You know, meditation, as you say, is sometimes overused, but I encourage people even to sit in quiet just for 5 moments, 5 minutes, and just try to connect to their deep inner essence and have their own dialogue with whatever form they perceive God to be, creator or whatever that is, and just begin to have an individual dialogue. Nobody else's prayers, just my own prayers, and just the struggles that I'm going through now.
And by the way, when it
Are
really
you still
comes
there?
Down... Yo, I'm here. When it really comes down to what we're really looking at is, you know, the retrieval part, whether it's indigenous, whether it's right here in a major city. I think if you go to some of maybe they don't have the strategies, the structures, because they're not living that way. But I really believe the soul retrieval, that some people try, it doesn't happen, but you can go into certain religions when they say come back to the church, whatever works. You're also dealing with, they're trying to do the same thing. Most of them don't get it, and that's why I think if you go back to the indigenous, they don't have the same challenges that you and I would have here in this country if we didn't know how to get to the soul.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And Carl Jung, whose work I just love, said that the closer we get to the tribal nature that we all came from, the closer we get to the spirit, the closer we get to spirituality, the closer we become aware that we are one with spirit and we are one with all that goes on around us.
And so much
of that has been blocked.
Oh, absolutely. And Jung said something else that made a lot of sense. He was talking about assumption. Assumption taken on as a, you know, fact is an incontestable conclusion. So assumptions taken on as fact. People run through their life living an assumptive life that has nothing to do with reality, but because they assume it and has worked for them, good or bad, in the past, they take it on as this is what reality is. And I really believe that a lot of people are running around through life not living reality. They're living assumption, and they're not living their own truth.
Absolutely. And so, and many times after, like we began this discussion talking about grief, many times after a difficult life experience, we move into what I like to, and you know, John of the Cross talked about this dark night of the soul experience. The crisis has driven us in there for us to really look at how far have we come on this journey. It can be a testing time, and it can be a time for us to really look clearly at what is truth for me and what is really my belief. And so that's why it's often referred to as the dark night of the soul, because sometimes those beliefs are challenged, and that can be a very painful thing, but it's also an incredible growth time, because sometimes we need to really take a look at the fact that beliefs have been given to us by other people, by our culture perhaps, by our teachers, but that may not be the truth. And it may not be actually our own knowing when we just sit in quiet and ponder and look at that in some depth and some intensity.
Okay, let's look at assumption. Let's go back to assumption. Let's talk whatever reality and whatever truth is. Maybe I'm in a relationship that every time I open my mouth, I get slapped. Now, for me, that's reality, and that's the way life is, and that's my truth. And I don't know any better, and I don't think, that, and then if I get out of that relationship, and you'll know as a psychologist, that deep down, I'm going to look for the same thing to validate what I think about myself. So there's got to be a tremendous shift in the way someone thinks about themselves to be able to open the door to the pathway for their soul journey.
And you described that very well, because reality is our reality. Our truth is our truth, and we live that until we find some evidence that says, oh, maybe there's another way to look at this. And so that's why when I speak and that's when I write, it is all about helping people take a look at who they really are, what is really you, what makes you, what, and are the behaviors that you're doing helping you to move forward to become a more empowered, soulful, spiritual person, or are they keeping you trapped in the reality that is now your reality, your lived experience? And so change in and of itself is hard. There's no doubt about that, because we keep slipping back into what we see as our truth. But that doesn't mean that we can't tiptoe forward and find new ways, and that those are the tests that we take. And so we tiptoe forward and we see, oh, well, I don't have to fear that anymore. That really, I can do that. And then we take another step and we take another step. So part of our work as a therapist is to help people take those baby steps and to move slowly into a new awareness and into a new reality.
No, sure. And I think there's that old adage that most people live by, and it's called better unhappy than unsure.
Indeed. Like we learn to navigate the angry waters pretty good, and so we don't know what's out there beyond them. But, and so that, again, is my job, to just help people put your toe in that water and just see how safe that is. And just know that you can survive that for 1 hour. And if you can survive that for 1 hour, how good do you feel? Can you try it for 2 hours?
Yeah, or can you try it for 2 minutes with some people? But
yeah,
I really
absolutely.
Now let's talk about, right to the book, Journey to the Sacred, Mending a Fractured Soul. What do I read the book, I pick it up word by word, cover to cover, I read it. What's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get from that book that I did not have before I picked it up?
I guess one of the biggest comments that really touched me and really made the whole writing of Journey to the Sacred worthwhile was from a woman. I worked for a time in a federal prison, and I've heard this repeated in several ways, but this woman really touched my heart when she said, "You gave me a language. You gave me a language to know that I'm much more than I ever thought I was. You gave me a language to be able to describe not only my soul and how that hurt because of the trauma that I've been through, but all that I want to ever communicate to people about the growth and the change and the happiness that I now feel." And she said, "Nobody ever else has ever given me that language or showed me ways that I can find joy in every moment, even though I've been through this tragic life."
Now, by the way, when we really take a look at this, isn't everything in and about language? There's a language of relationship. There's a language of computers. There's a language. So everything in and of itself has its own specific language. And just because you speak a particular language, English, French, the Dutch, whatever, does not mean that you know the language of your soul. And once you get that,
absolutely,
once you communicate with that, now all of a sudden, there you go. The disconnect is not understanding the language and what it takes to reach it.
Well, and that's really true, because, you know, language is, you know, just to be technical here for a moment, language, the language center is located for most people in the brain's left hemisphere. That's a very cognitive hemisphere. Many people who look at the brain, and Jung included, decided that soul doesn't understand words. Its language is symbol. Its language is beauty. Those are things of the right hemisphere. And so for about four centuries, we have become very, very focused on strengthening the skills of the left hemisphere, reading, writing, arithmetic, logic, analysis, words, but often at the expense of the soulful hemisphere or the right hemisphere, often at the expense of beauty, symbol, music, art, those kinds of things. And so there is a language of the soul, but it's very symbolic. It's not words. Words are perhaps only one lifetime bound and often carry very different reflections and very different meanings, and depending on the person who's receiving that message and their perception of that as well.
Oh, and by the way, You're also talking about the language of the unconscious mind, which is pictures and symbols. You get, something gets into that unconscious, it takes it on as a goal to achieve. And as far as language goes between people, with getting into left and right hand, left brain, right brain, based on what you say doesn't necessarily mean they hear it in the way that you meant it, and it's going to hit their symbolism in the unconscious, and that's also, quote-unquote, the language of the soul.
Yes, that's right. That's absolutely true.
Yeah.
And it's going to be filtered through all of that and filtered by all of their past experiences as well. And some
sure.
of that being their culture, some of that being their education, some of that being the family they grew up in.
Two areas of that. One is, if I say to you, if I ask you if you know what chamber around means, do you know what that means?
Chamber around? Chamber
around. Do you know what that means?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you do know
but
what it
describe
means.
It so that I describe it so that I understand what you're trying to describe to me.
There's the whole point.
If tell me what you mean by that.
Absolutely. If you're not familiar with the words, you're not going to have an image or a picture for it. But if I said to you, put a bullet in a gun, you have the image and the picture. Now we're on the same page. Just what you were talking about before.
That's right.
Because if it's not phrased in a way that other person has learned to receive it, it's going to go right over your head. And if you don't know anything about guns, you don't know what chamber around means. But if I say, put a bullet in a gun, now we're on the same page.
Indeed.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, and okay. So when we're talking about pain or when we're talking about soul, we have to be talking the same language in order for us to have a conversation.
No, absolutely no question about it. And I'll never say chamber around to you again, I promise. Okay, we're just
well,
about out of
time. It's actually a very good phrase.
Jane, let me ask you this. We're about out of time. Website we can find you at and buy the book and find out more about what you're doing.
Well, my website is Taking Flight International.
Okay,
the book is available. Sorry?
Go ahead. I was just going to
repeat the website. www.takingflightinternational.com.
Wonderful.
My work is...
Okay, go ahead.
My work is well described on the website, all the work that I do internationally. The books, my books, videos, CDs are also available on Amazon.com, but they must be careful to spell my name correctly. It is SimingTon.
And not Carl. I got it loud and clear.
That's right. Dr. Jane.
Yeah, okay. Hey, Dr. Jane, thank you so much for joining us. Good night.
Good night.
Hugging on you, miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only. 'Cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone. For you.
it now. Some of these days.
Whatever you've done, it's all over. Whatever you've been is so...
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking... What is it?
Talk.
Talk. I knew. Okay, we get older. We forget every once in a while. Conversations with Michael. Amy Lyman's here. She's the author of The Trustworthy Leader. The Trustworthy Leader, Leveraging the Power of Trust to Transform Your Organization. She spent close to 30 years studying organizations and groups and seeking to understand what helps some groups to thrive while others fall apart. Her focus is on the key contributions of trustworthy leaders to the creation and support of successful groups and organizations. This is an outgrowth of years of study, consulting, work, and observation. Amy, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. I just got a little feedback. I guess this is somehow... Okay, Seth, if you're listening to this, help. Amy, when we really come down to it and we talk about leaders and we talk about being trustworthy, do leaders have to take a class in learning what trust actually means? You may have a variation of whatever that word means. So when we deal with trust, is this something that you, in your research, had to redefine and really get a grip on what it was that was solid that could be overarching in all leadership?
Definitely through my research, I was able to come to an understanding of what it is that's common across the practices of all leaders. But it's not that their actions are all the same. The values that underlie what they do are common and a strong foundation. So there is no particular class in do this, do this, do this. There is certainly a developmental process that leaders go through, that anyone goes through,
sure,
who wants to develop their ability to be trustworthy and who wants to practice trustworthiness. But it's not, do this, turn left, take five steps. It's not at that level that people learn about how to be trustworthy. There are deeper experiences, more intensive experiences that people have over their personal life, growing up, as they develop, and their work life that really help them to understand and practice and use the power of trust.
Okay, now, when we say the power of trust, let's define trust on a practical basis, something we can wrap our arms around and say, oh, that's what trust is. So let's start with defining what is trust, especially with a leader.
Okay. The way that I define trust is as an emotional and a cerebral connection between people. And it is a bond that reflects a sense of confidence of one person that the other person will act in ways that are beneficial to my health and well-being. So I have confidence that that other person will do things that are good for me and of benefit to me, and I don't have to question it all the time.
Yeah.
And that's what trust is. It is that bond, that experience of connection and confidence.
Okay, and there's a very strong element in the definition of that word trust, loyalty. It's got to be a critical word.
Yes, yes. There is, loyalty is an outgrowth of that trust relationship. Because of trust, we are committed to the people that we trust. We have confidence in them. We are willing to follow them, to go along with them on journeys or projects or events where we don't necessarily know the final outcome, yet we trust that that person will act and engage in actions that are in our best interest or that will not be harmful to us, and so we're willing to go along with them. We are willing to make that commitment which is a sign of loyalty, absolutely.
But there also has to be the steps, and you know, your circle, the six distinct elements, the honor, inclusion, engaging followers,
right,
sharing information, developing others, moving through uncertainty. See, I think the key there is that's not something that somebody innately walks in with. That's going to be something that's a learned skill. And that doesn't mean that that anybody can do it. But what I'm saying is it's a learned skill. You've got to have whatever it is inside to be able to recognize what these things are. But there is a step. That's a process. That's step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 right there.
Well, there are skills that people use to convey the sense of honor that they experience as a leader. There certainly are the skills of communication that are very important. There are the skills of engaging with people, developing their talents, all of those kinds of things that leaders and managers need to be able to do. And yet there is also, I guess I wouldn't necessarily call it a skill as much as an awareness and understanding about oneself that runs deeply throughout each of the elements of the virtuous circle of the trustworthy leader. So the skills of showing that you are honored as a leader rest on the knowledge and self-awareness of the importance of reciprocity, the importance of practicing reciprocity and sharing with others, awareness of your position and the power that comes with your position, and how significant it is when you as a leader acknowledge someone and recognize them and elevate their importance in the organization because of your acknowledgement. So there's the behavior, the skill of being able to talk with people and being comfortable with people, and yet there is what it rests on, that sense of being honored as a leader, that being a leader is an honorable thing. That is what creates the trustworthy leader, that makes that person distinct from a leader who simply uses the tactics.
Okay, but here's the key. You talked about a foundation early on. And every business, every company, every corporation has a foundation whereby they make their decisions. That's where it comes from. Every once in a while, it's good if somebody comes in and looks at it through different eyes, looks over, quote unquote, the leader's shoulder and see what the leader doesn't see. So you got people like yourself who walk in, you study it, you're looking at it in a completely different way than they're looking at it and through a different perspective where you can see what they don't see. And I'm going to come back to it's developing. You talk about developing the high level of trust in the organizations. That doesn't come automatically. I still believe in my heart of hearts it is a learned skill. Because it doesn't mean that you don't have that innate ability to work with people and have people follow you. But there are things that you may not recognize that can cause you to be even a better leader.
You're right. There is a tremendous learning process that goes on in the development of a trustworthy leader. And it can be from an outsider coming in, as you say, and looking over the leader's shoulder and saying, what you just did there of recognizing people within the organization, inviting people into the decision-making process, acknowledging the different contributions of people on the team who just had that great success, that was evidence of your inclusive practices. And so it helps someone to recognize when you look over the shoulder of the leader and identify those key components and put it into a summary of, that's evidence of your inclusive practices. It helps that person then to say, next time I need to remember that that's important. Or when I'm coaching another leader and trying to bring that person up and help them to be trustworthy, I have something that I can watch for and help them to develop so that they become more trustworthy as well. So, yes, you're right. There are things that people do that they practice or that they might learn in a class that they're told, this is great for you to be, you need this skill as a leader. And then someone else can come along and help them to see what that represents in the kind of deeper scheme of things, sure. such as this, the model that I have pulled together of the virtuous circle of the trustworthy leader. So that's a very it's a very helpful tool, I find, in passing on the skills of the trustworthy leader and the knowledge of the trustworthy leader and helping to deepen someone's own understanding of what it is that they're doing that actually creates this trustworthiness in someone else's eyes.
And one other thing I think that's very important for a leader has got to learn to listen. There are too many people who don't listen, and leaders need to listen because it's extremely important that, well, you said it early on, that the people that you know, that are following, quote-unquote, get acknowledged, but there are so many of them that don't listen. And if they would just take that time, the bottom line would increase, because what you're dealing with here, when it really comes down to it, is leaders lead, but they're leading to go someplace, and if they're not, if it's a business, it's increasing their bottom line. If it's an organization, it's increasing something, whatever that bottom line is. If it's not income, it's something else, it's health, it's wealth, it's whatever. So realistically, I think that in and of itself, for a leader to realize that somebody else has something to say. There's a rule that I live by, and I probably said it 20 times a week, but it's so true. A good leader knows when to follow, and a good teacher knows when to be a student. And it, and you got to know when to change hats.
Yes, yes, that is so important. And it is a difficult thing for many leaders to understand the importance of followership and to acknowledge the importance of followership, how to cultivate it, how to develop it, and how to practice it themselves. As you point out, there are times when every great leader needs to be a follower because at that particular moment in time, it's someone else's turn to lead. And that's no diminishment of your role as a leader. You may be the CEO of the company, and yet there will be other moments when other people are the right ones to lead at that moment. Being comfortable being a follower and appreciating it and understanding it is really critical.
Oh, by the way, no question about it. And that's the power of a leader when they sit back. They know they're strong enough to take the hat off, quote unquote, for the moment and bring in the information that they need, which makes them a stronger leader anyway. But it is that knowing that they're strong enough to realize that if they back off and they listen, they're not going to fall down and nobody's going to take over.
Yes, yes. And, you know, one company that absolutely embodies that so well, so beautifully, is W.L. Gore and Associates. They have such a strong foundation of respect for followers and praise of the value of followership that for leaders, there's a natural kind of shifting back and forth of having leadership responsibilities, having leadership commitments that one has to fulfill, and yet easily being able to move into the followership position as well. It just moves back and forth. And boy, Gore has for years been an incredibly successful company financially, in terms of the strength of their culture, in terms of their reputation within their communities where they work, and also within the business community in terms of creativity and innovation. They're the kind of poster child for the importance of being a strong leader and being a strong follower.
Yeah, Amy, we're starting to run out of time, but there is a question I want to ask before we go. That, and it happens to all authors, whether when you decide to put something to pen, fact, fun, fantasy, fiction, it's all the same thing. There comes that time in the process of writing that there's that aha moment, there's that cathartic moment when you begin to realize something about the subject matter that you weren't even aware of. Where was that for you?
Well, actually, at the very beginning, as I went through all of the interviews and transcripts and was starting to put my model together, the notion of the honor of leadership kept, tweaking me, because often honor is thought of as a high praise, and, you stand up on the stage and you're honored because of your accomplishments. And the honor that I was hearing all of these leaders talk about, these CEOs and presidents and managing partners, was a personal honor. What an honor it was for them to be able to lead these people and lead this organization. And so there was a shift there in the start of the model and in my thinking and recognition. It fits so well with what else I was trying to write about and how I was understanding the power of trustworthy leaders. And yet that was definitely an aha moment for me, was understanding what it meant to these people to say, I am honored to be a leader in this organization.
Well, Amy, we're just about out of time again. Is there a website we can find you at, buy the book, find out more information?
Sure. The website is trustworthyleader.org, and you can buy the book there. There's more information. You can download the first chapter. There is a diagram of the virtuous circle and other materials that may be of interest to people as they seek to uncover their own virtuous circle and develop themselves into trustworthy leaders.
Wonderful. Hey, Amy Lyman, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, that's all.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold the leaves begin to fall, and a loving's burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
A dream lover will come my way, a girl to hold in my arms, and know the magic of her charms, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark, Conversations with Michael.
Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then.
Gina Estrada with us. She is the spokesperson for Little Miracles, A Journey to Financial Freedom, Business Networking with a Purpose. She's a networking expert, and she does it by utilizing the principles of Little Business Miracles book. She has personally facilitated over 15 small groups of business professionals in her community. And by studying and sharing the little miracles with others, Gina never has to make a cold call, because her business, she's developed a never-ending pipeline of people to talk to regarding her life insurance and investment practice. And she met Curlin Phipps and Damon Thomas in a networking group about 5 years ago. And it is as a result of their developing friendship, their partnership in ExpressoBrain.com was born. Gina, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm very excited to share with you tonight.
Okay, thank you so much for being here. And if I could get my way through that introduction, I can do anything at this point. Sometimes, you know, I'm going to write a book someday. Once you get through the intro, the rest of the show is great. By the way,
right.
Networking, where was it for you that networking was going to be that be-all, end-all, where you really caught on to it and realized that this is the trend for business in the future, now and in the future?
Well, growing up, I was the granddaughter of a preacher, and so I really didn't know a stranger. And that definitely helped me develop my networking skills in my early years. But later in life, when I joined my husband's insurance and investment practice of 38 years, I quickly realized that networking is how we need to do business still today, with all our internet transactions that we can do back and forth, send emails, but really in a business like ours, and I believe in business going forward, really that personal touch, that relationship building really needs to take place face to face.
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because when you really come down to it, you know, what was it that years ago, if you knew somebody who knew somebody who knew somebody, if you got 20 or 30 people, you had a lot of people. If you know how to do it today, you can reach hundreds of millions of people.
That's correct. So true. When I found Little Miracles, I was so excited because I had attended an evening event the night before I learned of Little Miracles. And I was speaking to someone, just meeting them for the first time, and they were handing me their brochures and like saying, if you refer people to me, I'll give you $500, and, you know, on and on and on. And I was like, oh my goodness, I don't even remember this guy's name, and he's trying to, you know, throw his stuff in my face. And I was like, how do I get out of here? And I didn't want to be rude, so I just sat there and listened to him speak. And so I left the event going, wow, I really need to work on how to end a conversation like that. And the next morning, there it was in my email, How to Politely End a Conversation by Mel Kaufman.
That's great.
And it was brilliant. I practiced what he said, and it was as simple as, well, it's really nice meeting you. I'm sure you have others here you'd like to meet, and I as well, and I hope to see you again in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. And what you bring up is a very interesting point. How many people, I don't mean literally a number, but how many people, Gina, really know how to end a conversation, how to walk away from it and leave it respectful?
I think the number of people that really have a plan for networking is small.
Yeah.
Since I studied Little Miracles and shared it with others, I can go into a networking event in my community and I can talk to someone. I can immediately tell if they have studied the Little Miracles because they just come off different. Like, they have a plan and they have a purpose for being there. Not just, hey, how's the weather? How's the game? You know, who's your favorite football team? I mean, you can talk about those things, but in a networking situation, usually you only have 3 to 5 minutes really to spend with each person if you're going to meet, you know, 4 or 5 people before it's time to start the event or time to sit down to a dinner or a luncheon. And those minutes are so important.
Oh, no, by the way, moving through this, and when I say moving through this, I think it's critically important to get as much as we can in the time allotted. Little Miracles has got 100 business tips miracles. Now, Mel Kaufman, obviously, who wrote it, he's almost 90 years old now, but there's a long life that this man must have had to create these little miracles. So what I'm hearing in the little 100 business tips in the miracles, it's just like that, how to quote-unquote, leave gracefully, how to say goodbye, how to do many of those things that most people just don't know how to do. And if you didn't know how to say goodbye to that particular person that you were talking to, you don't know that the next day that this guy could have been responsible for you meeting 100 people for your business.
Right, right. And that's what Little Miracles is all about. It's you can pick up the book and just take one little miracle and practice it, and it will change the way you do business for the rest of your life. Mel Kaufman is now 90 years old, and that's why he's kind of turned the reins over to me to carry out his good works. And I'm very excited to do that because, one, it puts me in front of a lot of people. It's so interesting learning about people's business and where they got started and where they're going and what their plans are for the future. And it allows me to speak to groups and organizations about networking with a purpose and having a plan. And it's amazing to see the light bulbs go on when I share this information. I also share it with high school seniors because it's important for them to begin learning the importance of building a good database and talking to their teachers and learning the about the people around them, because you never know, they may be their bosses someday.
You know, let me hold
picking
you
up this book is great.
Let me hold you up, because I think what you just said, wouldn't it be interesting if you can get a class or a course in high school with the Little Miracles? And the reason I'm saying that is this. These kids today are not prepared, and what the miracle sounds like, practical applications, something that for the most part you're not going to get in academia. This is on the job. This is out in the street. This is learning how to do it when without all of the glamour of a lot of these classes that people take. So in essence, what we're really dealing with is maybe, just maybe, these kids can walk out prepared, because I really don't believe that high schools today give them anything that will give them practical use when they get out of school, if they're not going to go out to college, to get out there and get a job and go to work.
You're absolutely correct. In fact, right now I have a couple technical colleges looking at the Little Miracles and seeing how they can incorporate it into their curriculum. So I'm working with them on writing a curriculum that would fit the courses that they offer, because it's so important, because you can get all the education in the world that you want to get, but if you can't actually go out there and apply it in a concise way, you know,
and
just because the education
most...
is there doesn't mean you can make things happen.
Oh, absolutely.
Sorry,
you know,
go ahead.
You can go to school and get all the education that you want. It's let's say that translates into something else when you get out, quote unquote, out onto the street. Translates into wisdom. You cannot learn wisdom in school. You can get education, but that doesn't allow you to get out there. That's what a Little Miracle sounds like to me. One of the most important things, and how many people know how to do this, how to convert chance meetings to money. I mean, that in and of itself is an art.
It definitely is. And Mel Kaufman was so brilliant in his writings. He was the membership director for a large chamber of commerce in Los Angeles, and that's really where he got his inspiration to write this book, because people would show up at networking events and really didn't know what to do, and they would just, you know, show up and then they would leave, and he didn't see business being transacted as a result of their efforts, and so that's when he decided to write the book and start educating those around him. There are thousands of business books out there on, you know, center of influence or networking or, you know, what to do in business, but really they're not practical applications. This is the only book I've found that actually step by step tells you exactly what to do, how to do it, and when to do it. And the results are amazing when you actually apply the Little Miracles.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And with Kaufman, he was the Wilshire Chamber of Commerce in Los Angeles. Wilshire Boulevard, I mean, that was the Miracle Mile. That was, at one time, that was a financial hub of the entire country. I don't know what it is anymore, but there was power there at one time.
You're so correct. And he would show up extra early, 5 a.m. He would show up and write the book, because he would just get to writing, because he really wanted his members to succeed in business as a result of joining his chamber.
I'm going to take you back now. Okay, you're in the insurance business, right?
Yes.
Okay. 1962. I know you weren't even around until 20, 30 years later. But 1962... I went to work for Washington National Life Insurance Company on a debit in South Central Los Angeles, and we were collecting 50 to 75 cents house to house for health insurance. And for there, I learned how to be very quick. And from there, ended up Wilshire Boulevard in Beverly Hills. And I went to work for Lincoln National Life, which is a whole different thing. And the key there was very interesting. In those days, it was a little bit of a different world. but the industry is still the industry. And if we could have had something like what you and what Mel have created, or what you're talking about, what a difference it would have made. But it came around when it came around, and it came to fruition when it was supposed to be.
Absolutely. I get thank you notes. In fact, I just got one this afternoon. That people that hear me speak or little miracles that I share with them, I get thank you notes all the time. They're saying, thank you so much for this tip. This is what happened as a result. I'm so excited, you know, and people will tell me, I've read the book 3 or 4 times through because every time I pick it up, I learn something new. And it feels good to get those thank you notes of people changing their business networking lives, even if you're in a dating situation. I think the little miracles could apply.
You know what you should do? Yes, you should go get your own radio show, and you call it the Little Miracle Show, and you can have a business show.
That's really interesting. We've kind of created a couple things along the line that we're just kind of prototyping right now. We've had Monday Morning Miracles, where it's a conference call for an hour on Monday mornings.
Yeah.
And I've had different people on, and we share things. So we've recorded those. And then we've had Wednesday morning breakfast where people come together and we have a guest speaker. And there's definitely a need, because now that we've stopped doing that, people are like, when are you going to start that up again? We really are missing that. We needed that on Monday morning, or we wanted to get together on Wednesdays. So there's definitely a need for it out there. Exactly what that's going to look like in the future, we're working on it. But I'm very excited that we've made the progress.
Yeah, Gina, we're running out of time now, but it's about time that you did something like this, because the way the economy is, everybody needs as much help as they can get. Gina Estrada, we're out of time. Website we can find you at?
www.espressobrain.com. That's espressobrain.com. We're also available on Amazon in Kindle format or hardcover. Just search Little Miracles, A Journey to Financial Freedom.
Wonderful. Hey, Gina, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Good night.
That's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment. And as the moment ends, got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
Oh, that was good. And that, my friends, is
a wrap.
If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.